to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com.
We spent the better part of 15 years looking at economic dislocations, primarily looking at the difference between the haves and the have-nots, and trying to find a root cause that as the economy grew, the distance between the haves and have-nots grew. And I stumbled across the work of the Chicago School of Economics back in the 1920s when they began to propagate the theory of macroeconomics. And I realized that their worldview and the view that is regnant in the global economy has two fundamental mistakes or untruths. One is that the blessings of nature are free, and the other is that labor can be exploited as much as you like. And I realized that that was the reason why the global economy was ripping apart communities, exploiting people, destroying ecosystems, and putting all of our future at risk for the temporary and ephemeral benefit of a few.
That's one of our guests today, Dr. Edward Cavetto, speaking to the mechanism that perpetuates the inequities and inequality of our monetary-based economic system. It's at the heart of why the movement for public banks is gaining acceptance around our country and, indeed, around the world. Hello, and welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. I'm Walt McCree, Ellen's co-host and chair emeritus of the Public Banking Institute. As we discuss money on this program, we like to not only delve into how it's issued, who issues it, the forms and sources of its issuance, and related impacts, but also we like to look at how it serves as a prime mover of community, society, and the economy. Money power is so overpowering that fundamental values of human community, respect for nature, and primacy of life's many forms are subjected to whether they fit into our monetary economic system objectives, essentially profits over people and planet. We can all recognize the truth of that. Perhaps we may even despair at how we can change things to reorder our affairs with new priorities. Well, today we'll discuss these matters with Ed Cavetto and also with Mark Anielski, an international economist and consultant and author of the book The Economics of Happiness, a look at how the common focus on monetary profits dominates and distracts our energy and attention away from the things that really matter, and how we can move our economies toward more lasting and regenerative practices and objectives. Well, let's talk to Ellen about it.
Ellen, here we are at the end of a very interesting week that involves some steps in public banking, and our program today is going to focus on aspects of that that touched on in previous programs having to do with what the bottom line economic interests really should be for people. Right now, it would seem like it's how much profit you can make, but most others, it's probably, are they able to succeed or make their way in an economy and having lives that are happy and well-balanced and enabled? See, those are drivers for our involvement in public banking. And our discussions this past week with Ralph Nader and his group in D.C. and with the National Council on Science and the Environment all touched on how people need to get engaged in bringing around a new economy with different bottom lines.
Right. And we're quite interested in network building. It does seem to me that they've got the money, we've got the numbers. So the only way we're going to prevail is to create a big movement, which public banking, of course, we see as instrumental because everybody's concerned about funding. So all these different movements that are all for worthy causes, but they're siloed. They're not really talking to each other. They all have their own interests, but they also all need funding. So if we could help tie them together in a sort of common thread, that would be super, sort of a sequel to Occupy. The Occupy movement pointed to Wall Street as the culprit, which actually people didn't necessarily understand before that. The fingers pointed at people buying homes that they couldn't afford, they should have known better, et cetera. It was sort of blamed on the homeowners, the subprime buyers, instead of the banks, which actually sucked these people into buying homes they couldn't afford and often putting them into loans that were inappropriate or that, you know, had worse terms than they could have gotten. So Occupy pointed to the problem, but there wasn't a unified solution or even really any solution. I think I read somewhere that they intentionally didn't focus on the solution because people would disagree on that. And the one thing they could agree on was that it was the fault of Wall Street. So anyway, now we're at the stage where we do need to focus on a solution. What do we do about it? We all know we've got a money problem or various problems that are all related to not having sufficient funding. So how do we fix it? So if we can kind of get a common front on that, we could build a big movement.
I think that's an interesting analogy because the Occupy movement brought into public parlance an understanding that there was a 99% / 1% differential built into the economy that people hadn't ever noticed. And this is in a lot of ways what the public banking movement is providing as well, is noticing how the banking system is monopolized and controlled and how it stands in the way of us building better economic outcomes or prospects and also undermining our democracy. So we are bringing that into parlance. And what we're finding, I think, in our conversations, Ellen, is that the other interests who are committed to things like affordable housing and fair student lending and small businesses and renewable types of energies and all of those things are all separate interests that work on their own, and that the public banking topic brings together a common interest. We all need funding for our projects. So that kind of silo busting, if you will, does set a new stage.
Mm-hmm. And to me, the game changer is the revelation, what money reformers have been saying for a century, but the Bank of England and the Bundesbank have finally acknowledged that banks aren't merely intermediaries taking in money and lending it out again, but they actually create our money supply. And 95% of the money supply is created by banks when they make loans. So when you realize that, then you realize that it's basically a no-brainer that we the people should own the banks. I mean, it should be a cooperative. In other words, not only as a matter of equity should the money go back to the people, but it's only sustainable if the money goes back to the people. Because if all your money is created as a debt, you've got to pay off that debt. And if the money is not paid back into the system, then it's not going to be there to pay the debt. And therefore, you have this growth of debt, which grows exponentially and is ultimately unsustainable. So the only way to make it sustainable is to do it on a cooperative model where the money all stays within the system. It all gets spent again. And that's what a government would do with its funds. It spends its funds on various projects that serve the people and get the money out there to pay for workers and materials.
So the process here is one of public education about how things work now, but also how we are going to create a new systemic approach for managing these things.
You could also say another game changer is that the internet and this whole cryptography, et cetera, that there are ways to actually eliminate the middlemen, not entirely, but anyway, the system has gotten much more efficient. You can do things automatically, and so we don't really need these middlemen like we used to, like even for issuing bonds. And I saw that you don't even need middlemen for investing, that there are computer programs that can tell you where to invest.
Yeah. So we're bringing in a 21st century awareness about how the banking system works and the systems that we're using now and the technologies that might allow us to move forward with different commitments to and priorities for public service. Mm-hmm. So our guests are going to be expounding on some of these things. I think very interesting about Dr. Cavetto talking about creating an economy worthy of our affection, which is a very interesting notion in and of itself. And then hearing from Mark Anielski, who wrote the book on Economic of Happiness, about how we can really as practically include that as an objective for the monetary management that we want to create for the 21st century, for an economy and a political system that takes care of public interest or as a primary purpose. So let's go to those conversations, Ellen. Thanks.
Okay, thank you.
Our guests on today's program move the focus of our discussion about money from a set of values established by market reckonings to a reawakening that reacquaints us with the underlying principles of what money is for, what it achieves, and actually what it is. Many people would offer answers to those questions based on notions of consumption, accumulation, control, and power, while answers like trust, relationship, service, and love may not even be considered, or might even sound out of place. Our common understandings of economic matters tend to overlook these softer aspects, and yet our guest today would point out that this oversight is a fundamental misreading of the role that money plays in establishing community and societies. We've been misled by celebrating money as a commodity rather than a utility for sharing and collaboration. Ellen and I recently presented to a conference workshop in Washington that discussed cooperative ownership and public banks as the backbone of a sustainable economy, which addressed a fundamental reframing of the conventional consumer economy. Our host for that session was Dr. Ed Cavetto, who spoke with us about this direction as moving us toward an economy worthy of our affection. Dr. Cavetto is the Director of Regenerative Design for the Foresight Plus Innovation Lab in the San Francisco Bay Area.
An economy worthy of our affection is a provocative notion. And you brought this into our world in using this kind of a languaging, which seems to be, the more I look at it, well, it sounds fanciful, is actually foundational.
So we spent the better part of 15 years looking at economic dislocations in several geographies, in Europe, in Africa, in Asia, and throughout North America, primarily looking at the difference between the haves and the have-nots, and trying to find the root cause of what we thought was causing this, that as the economy grew, the distance between the haves and have-nots grew. And I began looking under rocks, trying to find root cause, and then I stumbled across the work of the Chicago School of Economics back in the 1920s, when they began to propagate the theory of macroeconomics. And I realized that their worldview and the view that is regnant in the global economy has two fundamental mistakes or untruths. One is that the blessings of nature are free, and the other is that labor can be exploited as much as you like. And I realized that that was the reason why the global economy was ripping apart communities, exploiting people, destroying ecosystems, and putting all of our future at risk for the temporary and ephemeral benefit of a few. And I thought, so how to unwind that? And I began looking for economic theories that would be contrary to the regnant global economic theory of macroeconomics. And what I say now in my MBA classrooms is that macroeconomics is a lie, and I say it to be provocative. And I also say that the greatest public health crisis that's ever faced our species is the global material economy, because it causes climate shift, it causes disease, it causes immiseration of communities, poverty, and hunger. And I thought, there's got to be somebody who thinks differently, and I stumbled across Rudolf Steiner's work. Now, Steiner, as you may know, is a philosopher and an artist, an educator, an industrial designer, and most of all, an economist who wrote in Austria in the 20s and 30s, and he writes of what he calls the associative economy or associative economics. And in that theory, he says a few simple things, the most fundamental of which is that land is not a commodity, but a blessing. People are not a commodity, but a community. And money is ephemeral and transient. And that if we don't stop treating those three verities differently, we'll get it wrong. And he wrote this in the 30s. He said that if we continue exploiting land and people in the way that we do, and pretending that money was the only real goal, we would eventually reach a problem in our social and ecosystems. And this was predicted again in the 1970s by a book called Limits to Growth, the Club of Rome, which was the predecessor to the World Economic Forum, the titans of industry and policy and public affairs, convened a study to figure out why, in the late 1960s and 1970s, the following phenomenon was observed. As economies in countries would grow, communities and ecology would start to collapse, and they didn't understand why, and they did it not because they cared about ecology and communities, but they cared about making more money. So they commissioned a study that was completed by two professors from MIT, and the lead researcher was Danella Meadows. And in her book, Limits to Growth, she predicted in 1972 that if the false reality of artificial value extracted from the economy through manipulative financial instruments continued at the current pace, that eventually ecosystems would begin to collapse and communities would begin to fall apart, that social impacts would be dramatically adverse, that civic engagement would fall through the floor. And of course, all of those predictions have come precisely true. So I began pounding on lecterns, rustling up philanthropies, companies, universities, and cities around the need to create a new economic model. And to modernize the notion of associative economics, I seized on the affectionate economy. And I'll stop in just a minute. But what I'll say is, it's a simple notion. I'll tell you the metaphor I always use. I tend to wear cowboy boots because they're the most comfortable shoes in the world, and I ride horses. And these boots have to be repaired from time to time. I could go to any one of a number of large corporate cobblers who have many, many outlets here in the Bay Area, but I go to a man named Cesar, who runs a little shop in a town called Mountain View. And I met him when I lived there. And I've met his wife and his children. I've had dinner at his home. And when I give him $20 to repair my boot heels, I know exactly where that money goes. And I have great affection for that transaction. When I pay a random airline for my daughter to come visit at holiday, I have great affection for that transaction. And our simple theory is that if every economic exchange in the world had that sort of intention, that we would suddenly flip the script and begin thinking about what it is to be human, to be in possession of the gifts of nature, and to transact for value fundamentally differently.
I love the Rudolf Steiner concept. I used to read a lot of Rudolf Steiner, but do you know which book that was where he went into the economics of it? I agree, money is ephemeral. We have this idea that money is a thing, a commodity that you have to acquire by digging it out of the ground or buying it in some way, and that it lasts forever. And so it's sort of this independent thing that we're always trying to acquire and that is kept intentionally scarce by the money creators, which are the banks. But in fact, money should be or is just pluses and minuses. It's debits and credits. We now know that all of our money is created by, or virtually all of it is created by banks when they make loans. So when the loans are paid off, it goes back to zero. So it's really just an accounting function. But anyway, I'd be curious to read Steiner on that.
There's three books, and they have a beautiful symmetry to them. The most profound explication of this is in a series of books called The Lectures to the Workers. In 1932, he began lecturing to the workers at the Waldorf cigarette factory in Austria, of all things. And it was on the back of this set of lectures, which was about the nature and the future of work, the nature and the future of work, and the dignity and purpose that comes from meaningful human work. Of all things in a tobacco and cigarette factory. On the back of that, he conceived the Waldorf education model. So the second book that's relevant is called The Root of Education, which is the backbone for the global Waldorf education movement and educational framework. And the third book is called The Heart of Economics, which was the latest work. But he built this idea of the associative economic model from a set of lectures to workers about the future of work and the nature of work, and then threw into the Waldorf principles of how you teach real human living to children. And then he began to develop a contrary macroeconomic theory that he called the associative economy. So it's those three works that build the scaffolding of this idea.
And rather than creating some formulaic mathematical construct around economies and economic study, it seems like it's shifting the focus from accounting to relationship.
Exactly. Yeah. Because when we account for money on double entry ledger sheets or with Quicken, either way, we begin to alienate ourselves from our labor and our humanity. But when we remember that the entire global economy is based on photosynthesis, we'll think differently. The entire macro economy that we so arrogantly propound as a function of international debits and credits and monetary exchange and the value of various currencies and the false value of stock traders who only trade in currency, to the direct immiseration of ecosystems and communities around the world, mostly communities of color in the Southern Hemisphere, we forget that nothing that are the fruits of our economy, nothing we see around us as human artifacts, absolutely nothing would exist without photosynthesis. So our fundamental stewardship obligation as people in the global economy is to protect the ecosystems that support life on the planet. And they are collapsing while we rush merrily along towards, quote, more economic value, which is just false in every way. But anyway, yes, that is the rootstock of it. Exactly.
But that is so central. The blinders come off. Of course, you know, we have to have a much greater macro view about what's really operative. And that is what you're suggesting is a change in the paradigm of our economic reckoning. And I'm going to quote something that you put in one of your pieces called Building an Economy Worthy of Our Affection from Steve Kuhn on the structure of scientific revolutions, talking about overturning a previously accepted paradigm, not coming about from gathering new facts that call the paradigm into question, but that logic doesn't change people's lives and that a society's grasp needs to be focused on something other than logic. Other than, in other words, the numbers and the calculations and the theories, something far deeper and more difficult to articulate, which he calls by various names, emotion, the irrational, the metaphysical, or faith. Now, those are not words
yep.
you get in the economic lexicon or in the syllabi, you know.
Except I would tell you, Walt, except you're absolutely right. This is brilliant. Except I would tell you that I've advised students who are pursuing their PhD in economics who come to me because of my different approach. And I've worked with very credentialed, highly esteemed economists in various faculties on which I've taught. And they say repeatedly in their lectures and their texts, the basic functionality of the macroeconomic model that supports global exchange is faith in markets.
Uh-huh.
Faith is at the center, but it's a very different kind of faith to what Kuhn was talking about. They say it all the time. They say trust and believe. And nowhere do you see that more centrally than this horribly false and deeply cruel notion that if we just leave markets alone, perfect exchange will create frictionless bartering and good value. It doesn't exist. The more information you have, the richer you are. Those who have little have no information except the daily painful wages of being immiserated from their labor and living in communities increasingly polluted and decimated by the power of the global economy that puts faith in something but not in the right thing.
Faith is also what you see, for example, with the cryptocurrency investors. Most people really don't understand what it is. They just see that it's going up, and so they have faith that it's going to keep going up. It's a gambling instinct, a speculative instinct, but not based on, you know, it's more of an emotional, psychological thing than fact-based.
Another dimension of this, Ed, which again I'm quoting from your article called Access to Capital and Economic Renewal, the Public Banking Imperative, you quote John Bloom, who's a senior director of the RSF Social Finance Organizational Culture. He said, may we proceed based upon an understanding that all economic activity is actually initiated by gift, such as each of our breathing lives is supported at the outset by the gift of nourishment. That fluid gift is transformed through human development into capacities for new ideas and recognition of the needs of others. This is a snapshot of how a healthy culture contributes to economic renewal. The notion of gift and faith. Here we are again talking in another dimension, hardly recognized as science, but certainly as part of the cultural mores and value systems that underlie our economic systems.
I think it's also the reliance on numbers that are so divorced from nature and the ecology and the people that are suffering. You see these pictures, you know, of stockbrokers who are just watching the numbers going up and down and figuring out how to make their numbers go up relative to other numbers. And then nobody's seeing the workers that are suffering. I mean, somebody is losing while those people are winning. But they, from their point of view, they're only winning numbers. They're winning a lottery sort of thing. And they're not seeing the damage that's being done. It's divorced from the reality that it represents.
And we come now to the fulcrum of change. We come now to the lever point. The reason that our organization, the Foresight and Innovation Lab, works the way that it does to shift organizational culture in philanthropies, communities, universities, and companies is because our theory of change is that if we can reintroduce or marry back across that line of divorce, if we can reintroduce or marry back people to their humanity and help them see, like Steiner wrote about, the beauty and dignity of human work and the relationship of human work, not to artificial, manipulative, attenuated value that makes money for Wall Street and for Bonn and for Paris and for Singapore. I refer to the city of London, all the financial centers, but instead creates well-being for communities and humans, then our theory is if we can run around fast enough, shift enough organizations, then we will create an appetite for the affectionate economy. And I'll give you one more quote that goes to the center of our work and how we try to intervene in communities to get them to think about public banking and cooperative. This is from Charles Handy, who is an economist who taught at Yale in the 40s. He said in a book about organizational development, "The organizations that survive longest are those that work out what they uniquely can give to the world, not just growth or money, but their excellence, their respect for others, or their ability to make people happy. Some call those things a soul." And so we come to faith and soul, and we believe that every organization has a soul because every organization is built up of humans who, whatever your religious or theological disposition, I think all of us will accommodate that there is something metaphysical about consciousness and the way that the brain creates self-awareness. And those forces that drive us to be fundamentally curious capstone predators who are always trying to discover and make an impression. If we go back to our biology and the upright hips and the 1.3 kilograms inside of our skull that make all the difference in this concept of mind, and if we think about how we feel about our children and our communities and those dearest to us, if we can bring those verities into the workplace, if we can, in other words, work from love, that is to say, do work that we love in organizations that we love because they have a soul and there's certain things they won't do for money. And we've been asking that question for over 25 years of companies. What are the limits of what you'll do for money? When you awaken people to that, sometimes things shift in a very tectonic way and organizations start behaving very differently. And I think in that lies the seed of propagating, just like a gardener propagates a healthy garden, propagating the garden of the affectionate economy globally.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a good of public banking, too. Like you say, you can't just let the market go. I mean, how are you going to get people to see it that way? Some people will, but if you actually have a charter, for example, for a bank that says, this bank will serve the public interest and it won't do X, Y, and Z, and it will do A, B, and C. In other words, it has to be legislated in there. It has to be the rules. You have to be a system based on rules that are pro-life.
I would say rules or values.
I think it's norms. I think it's rules, values, norms. We have to think about all of them because you need lawyers, I'm sorry to say. You do need lawyers to write organic documents like constitutions and bylaws, but they serve a purpose, right? And then the values are the things that define what we will do and not do. But the norms, maybe the norms matter most because the norms are the habits of being, the habits of heart and mind. the mental and heart frames that go beyond rules and values into the very heart of how we conduct ourselves. I would offer you one thought. One of the things that, so we do a lot of our work in Silicon Valley, which is perhaps the worst company culture bed in the world. And one of the things that nobody in Silicon Valley does is listen to each other. It's amazing that this valley has been able to generate what it does because nobody listens to each other. When we intervene, we have a commission with the largest employer in the world right now, a company called Flex. And when we intervene in the biggest, most wealthy, heavily capitalized, largest manufacturing company in the world and get people to listen to each other, people are astonished at what they learn and how differently they see their colleagues and affection rather than prioritized what sort of value do you bring to business emerges. Mm-hmm. So anyway, it's a brilliant point about public banking. When you exist to create well-being, when it is against the law for you to be exploitive, and when it is required of you to be working always for the common good, and that's why I was so struck when I first saw the public banking model in the Netherlands. Yes, you have a fundamentally different charter way of being, and you're propagating norms with every transaction.
Right, and people can actually sue over that. Whereas right now, if you tried to sue J.P. Morgan Chase or whatever for exploiting, they say, well, that's what we do. That's our business model. We're a corporation. We're there to make money. But you could sue a public bank that was not serving the public interest.
It's very interesting, too, at the outset of creating a new state bank in New Jersey, for example, the first language is out in the Senate bill about that, about creating that new institution, and it has a good delineation of who does what and what its mission is and so forth. But at some point, it occurs to me that maybe now we ought to sort of insert a values-based statement about a bigger purpose for the bank that's not, and that in addition that serves these particular sectors. And I'm wondering if it isn't a time for us in our culture and in our economy to start talking like that, to actually talking about the values and priorities of community, relationship, responsibility.
I think it is, and you make a fundamental point about cause and effect, Walt. The reason that I've been teaching disruptive and comparative finance and business model alternatives in MBA programs, progressive MBA programs, for coming on 20 years now, is because we don't teach people that there's an alternative. And so we've been teaching about the public banking model. We've been teaching about how capital markets really work and what the market failures are that are driven by capital markets. We've been teaching about the cooperative business model and whether it's a community or worker-owned cooperative, how wonderfully nurturing and resilient and catalyzing those models are to create community well-being. We've also at the same time been building measures of community well-being at the city and town level for coming on 20 years to watch people measurably see how well-being increases. We can do a whole separate conversation on metrics of community well-being, but the point is I've now proposed a class to my old law school, UC Berkeley's Bolt Hall, on the principles of legality that structure capital markets, and it's a course in comparative legal approaches to corporate forms, and everything from B corporations to benefit corporations to the public banking laws need to be reconsidered, and I'm hoping that I can help sort of create a new generation of young lawyers who will go into the world, and when they create organic documents like bylaws, or if they work in legislatures or as elected officials passing laws that affect our economy, they'll think about the importance of humanity, affection, respect, and community well-being. And I think it's absolutely timely to think about what you're doing in New Jersey to add a higher level of both purpose and principle to those organic documents, not just so that somebody can sue, because as a California licensed attorney, I'm required to discourage people to sue because the only people who win in most lawsuits are lawyers, but to remind people of what they're about, of how they're supposed to be in their work in those kinds of institutions, if that makes sense.
Are there any kind of canonical platforms on which the law speaks to the primacy of human outcomes?
Well, yes, there are. And in the United States, it's as fundamental as it gets. If you look at the case law around the Constitution, and a simple sentence that we forget about all the time. It's fascinating how bright jurists, far too many of them, women are people of color, but how bright jurists for 240 years have interpreted the language. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men, in quotes, are created equal. And we continue on to the three pillars of what the constitutional amendments sit upon in our Declaration of Independence. The Republic is founded to enable communities of fellow citizens to pursue life, liberty, and happiness. Well, happiness, say the scribes of constitutional theory, was supposed to be the economy. And so we have Mark Anielski's perfect work embedded in our constitutional document. And there's a raft of laws underneath that that create a group of civil rights, such as the right to control one's own body, the right to speak your mind, the right to have dignified work. And so there are some very fundamental, as you say, canonical structures within our legal system. But because of the fact that we have a media, and now a social media, that is primarily constructed to distract and anesthetize and immiserate us from our humanity, and because we don't have, as Edward R. Murrow argued for in the 50s, national evenings of conversation and news broadcast,
right,
as you do in your work, as this is why public television exists and public media exists, to have national conversations about public affairs, as Bill Moyers would put it, because we don't do that with any regularity or with any systemic approach. We don't remember these things, but we have these tools. We simply choose not to use them.
But there's also what has evolved in our culture, systems of, as you say, distraction, evisceration, and of our core relationships. The churches are in decline. The community volunteering networks, which, though vibrant, tend to be on the periphery of core civic activities. The whole distraction of the media has produced a much different culture, and in which our conversation sounds so foreign as to be a fantasy. So getting back to that is going to require people to renounce their pursuit of some of the quote-unquote benefits of the monetary constructs that we're engaged with.
But what I have found, Walt, I'll tell you a story in a minute. What I have found time and time again is reintroducing people to their humanity flips a switch. Right. When a husband leaves a wife, when a life mate leaves a life mate, when a parent departs from a child to go to work, it had darn well better be the case that what they do at work improves the quality of life of that child. Else, why do we step away from those relationships? We've forgotten why we work. We do not work for a retirement fund. We work to come home and see the joyful expression on the faces of our children. And if I leave my home and my children and my most deepest love to go into the workplace, I had darn well better be able to resolutely justify that by doing work of quality, purpose, and dignity that will directly make their lives better. And that reintroduction, we have found, I'll tell you a story about a large German manufacturing company we were working with about 15 years ago to do this kind of work, and we were struggling to get them to see the importance of recognizing this reality, because among other things, our failure to do this puts our companies at risk. Some of the biggest companies in the world have disappeared because they lost the plot on ethics, humanity, culture, and well-being. And I can give you chapter and verse, but never mind. We're working with this large German industrial firm, and I can't get anybody to get the picture of the fact that their way of growing and exploiting resources, they're a mining company, was going to eventually take them down. Because I'm a futurist. I ran some scenarios and saw that the way they were running was going to prevent them from growing and eventually cause them to become unstable, unhealthy, and quite upside down economically. But I couldn't get the executives to listen, so I went into the boardroom one afternoon to tell them my recommendations. And as I began to describe what they were doing to ecosystems and communities in Africa where they extracted their wealth from, I had gotten pictures of the board's grandchildren and nieces and nephews and children. And without even referring to the pictures, I went from some slides about economic depredation and the fragile state of the business to starting to flash pictures of their children and their nieces and nephews and grandchildren. And it was a bold and perhaps career-limiting move, but I was out of options. And this is a big, famous name-brand German industrial firm. We're in the boardroom, and we've spoken about this publicly, so I can talk about this. They've done conference presentations on their shift and why they conduct themselves the way they do. And I had stodgy, triple PhD finance German executives in tears when I talked about the fact that you need to understand that there are children who are hungry and wanting for food because of the fact that you're wealthy and sit on the 85th floor of this tower in Bonn. If you don't see that reaction, this will eventually catch up with and overtake your children. And if you don't believe me, then send us away. But if you think there's something about this that may have purchase and truth, then please listen to our advice and you will become stronger economically, more respected ethically. You'll be successful in the marketplace and you'll reestablish what it is to be a mining company and change how people regard what it is to do extractive commerce. And eventually, as a restorer of ecosystems, you will be respected, your stock value will rise, et cetera, et cetera. And ultimately, we won the day after a very risky play. But I go back to what you said, Walt, and this is a thread of what Ellen said. If we can reawaken our humanity and find human dignity, humanity, and purpose at work of a kind that relates to our dearest relationships, in other words, if we can love our work because we love our organizations, because they love the world, or have what Charles Handy calls soul, then we have the very definition of integrity, which is alignment between all of our actions.
And this is how we build an economy worthy of our affection. Nicely put, Edward. Thank you very much.
I'm very honored that you think this is worthwhile. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you, Ed. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks.
Ellen and I were speaking with Dr. Ed Cavetto of the Foresight Plus Innovation Lab. We have to measure what matters, says international economist and writer Mark Anielski, who challenges the metric known as the gross domestic product, or GDP, as an ineffective indicator of national economic outcomes. His new book, called An Economy of Well-Being, Practical Tools for Building Wealth and Happiness, opens the discussion around what we're really producing and what we ought to be trying to produce as a genuine measure of our economy. Ellen and I spoke with Mark about his new work.
What I propose is that we're measuring what matters. What Bobby Kennedy said is if what's wrong with GDP is we're not measuring what matters. Then what I propose is we're measuring the conditions of well-being as we experience well-being, both objectively but also experientially or subjectively. So my model, it's an accounting model, says we measure the conditions of well-being of nature, of our economy, of our households, of our streets, and our infrastructure. And we can do those measures in sort of quantitative terms, but we can also ask people how they feel about their well-being, how they experience hope, life satisfaction, quality of their sleep, whether they feel they make enough money to meet their life needs. Do they experience financial stress? These are, I think, measures that address Bobby Kennedy's long-standing challenge, which is let's come up with a different accounting system that actually celebrates the things that make life worthwhile.
There's also the accounting issue of the things on the other side of the balance sheet. In other words, like the government, our government is $21 trillion in debt, but they don't count what that $21 trillion bought. I mean, there's assets on the other side of the balance sheet that a corporation would count when they were figuring, like a bank would figure assets and liabilities and say, okay, it comes out to zero, we balance. But with the government, they call that a debt. So it does seem like there's something wrong with how we measure not just happiness, but actually measure what we've got and whether that's a big problem.
As a public accountant, I sit on the province of Alberta's audit committee, and I started in the accounting world, and it's now PwC. And I learned, in my years in government, that in fact we had no public accountants don't prepare proper balance sheets for nations or states or provinces or municipalities. And what does that mean? It means that, there's no proper accounting for land or resources and assets. There's certainly no proper accounting. If we count the debt, are we actually counting the interest costs of that debt as a serious line item, which now in my rough estimates for the U.S. suggest that interest payments alone, gross interest payments on national debt, are probably the largest expenditure, even exceeding military. And yet nobody talks about it. And so we need a proper balance sheet that has those assets and liabilities and even equity, which is really about the distribution of wealth or well-being. Imagine if you reported that for the state of California or New Jersey, and you would actually show the distribution of well-being conditions in society. That's what I'm proposing. That's why I'm coming at it from a sort of just a conventional accounting approach, and saying even accountants have not, after 500 years of accounting, have some work to do.
And I know you've traveled considerably around the world, and one of your stops has been Tahiti, and worked with the native people there, and they have a different kind of reckoning about this business, don't they?
Well, the Polynesians are one of the early civilizations that use seashells as money. And so I was invited there 5 years ago, met with the president, and not just with the indigenous Polynesians or Tahitians, but with the official government of Tahiti, and said, to President Tamaru at the time, we could be a pioneer. You can actually be ahead of Bhutan, which has a gross national happiness, by incorporating this well-being economy, Economie Bonaire in French, because they speak French and Tahitian, into the economic system. And so I just came back and was there in November, did a 2-week project developing an index of well-being for part of the island of Tahiti, a community of about 9,000 people, in which the hope is that by asking citizens, and citizens would tell me that nobody ever asks us how we feel about our life. We're asked about opinions about things like climate change, or politicians try to suggest what we should think about. But when are we ever asked how well we sleep at night? And so we're hoping that this initiative will be the first. It's a pilot, but we hope to affect the entire country, and even possibly France, who is still their colonial master. So.
How do you get into the conversation with accountants, with government accountants, with those kinds of denominators, asking people how they feel about and how well they sleep? I mean, how does that register on the government accounting and financial management frontier?
Well, in some of the progressive, like Alberta and other states where we've had a sort of commitment to full accounting of or different performance metrics, the Ministry of Health here in Alberta has taken my advice and are incorporating subjective well-being surveys into how they're profiling health. So it's not just diabetes rates or heart disease. It's about how people feel about their life satisfaction. And those are becoming now more mainstream in the profiling of community health, shall we say. So of course, and we know that there's enough evidence from Gallup and others that, happier employees, better workplace well-being translates into more healthier financial bottom lines. So that's the connection we're trying to make. It's we're still early days, but I think I'm hopeful that from an accountability perspective, governments are starting to say, well, maybe this approach to asset management, broadly speaking, so we're going to incorporate these so-called intangibles like social capital and human capital into, asset management of a municipality are actually viable. And so I've got a couple of municipal clients, even the City of Victoria, now interested in this approach. And I get more traction, I would say, at the municipal level. And higher up you go, I think the less, because you're just less relevant to literally the neighborhood.
That's what we've seen around the country, certainly in the public banking initiative as well. The local levels matter.
And speaking of public banking, you have a really interesting public bank there that you've written about and I've written about. Do you want to talk about that?
Yes. Yeah, Alberta Treasury Branch, or ATB Financial, started
not really
80
a bank,
years ago.
But
well, actually, can't call ourselves a bank because we'd be sort of out of bounds with central financial authorities in Ottawa. But, ostensibly, ATB is a full financial services financial institution. 730,000 Albertans are members of a population of 4.1 million. So highly successful, full service, even more financial service than the Bank of North Dakota. And hardly anybody knows about it. Actually, 10 times the asset portfolio of Bank of North Dakota. And so I've been talking to the premier here and others saying, do we even know what we have? And can we do more with this thing? Can we hold some of our own debt, for example, instead of going to Wall Street and selling our bonds? And so those
right.
are the really interesting strategic questions we're debating right now. We're writing a little policy paper on ATB, and we're saying, let's tell the world that we've got this 80-year-old institution that's that can lend money at cost. It doesn't have to pay a profit, doesn't have to generate a profit, and doesn't pay taxes because the people own the bank.
When you say the people own the bank, is it government money, tax money that's put in there? Or does it just belong to everyone?
It belongs to everyone. I have my business account. Our daughters have their personal bank accounts. We treat it just like it would be TD Bank. I mean, it's just, or a credit union. So we have full financial services, credit cards, investment services, don't have insurance. And the only thing that doesn't happen is ATB doesn't lend to the government as Bank of North Dakota does. And that's one thing I'm suggesting ATB could do. It could expand its role there under a public banking kind of mandate.
To the aspect of happiness and well-being as an economic design, you're also working with Native tribes who are looking at their sovereign right to have their own banks. What are any of those qualities being incorporated in some of their thinking?
The nice thing about working with what we call First Nations here is that their community may be 1,000, and the biggest one's 10,000. So you're dealing with literally neighborhood scale nations and with the capital N. In Canada, that means that these nations have rights under treaty to the benefits of their natural resources, to their land. And what I'm showing them is that you can create a sovereign wealth fund, sovereign wealth kind of architecture, including a bank. But I would start with the trust. I would start with the proper structure of a 5 capital asset trust that you then basically it becomes your securitized asset portfolio. And so now you're in control of your destiny. And so there's a few chiefs, the Six Nations are interested in talking to me about creating the first Iroquois bank. So that would be cross-border, including the Onondaga and upstate New York and the Mohawk and Quebec. And there's two First Nations here I'm working with. And we start with an asset assessment. We prepare the balance sheet first, and then we will think about how do we structure the fund management team, which will be local, but we still have to train them and get them up and running. And so they operate at arm's length with chief and council. So it's a pretty interesting new frontier.
Bringing in quite a different profession of banking into tribal accounting, I would think. Yeah. Now, will there ever be a point, in your view, as the sovereign nations bring forward some new models, that we would actually be able to quantify or monetize the natural assets of these places? In terms of using it in some ways, capital.
If we know something about banking, it was always about is this a collateral grade asset? And so my specialty is natural resource accounting and natural asset accounting. So the most valuable asset I have is land and natural resources. So what we do is we value the natural resource. So they have natural gas. Well, we value that at market value. But we also look at, I'm using my government, but when I look at the value of land, for example, it's not just natural gas market value, it's also the value of the trees and sequestering carbon. It's their traditional use of the land, the herbs and medicines and spiritual sites, sacred sites. And I calculate the value of those assets as well, or at least the value of those benefits from the land. So it's not just, it's a spectrum of value. Now, the accountants, the Deloittes or KPMGs might say, well, we will only verify your natural gas asset value. And I say, all right, that's already a lot of asset. And then we can, through basically notes of the financial statements, add those other non-market values, which are of material importance to the nation, if not the conventional financial world. But for them, it's important because they're always balancing. We need to generate income from what we have, but then we also need to ensure our elders are healthy and our traditions are healthy. So it's an interesting, and we're getting closer now to mimicking nature than just pure, you know, economic output and GDP and profit maximization. So that's kind of exciting. And there's some really important precedents happening in the world, like the Maori just secured the rights of their sacred river as a person, so as a legal standing now, the first time in the Commonwealth. So that means that precedent would apply to other Commonwealth countries like Canada. So that this is really exciting. So now the question, the Ganges River just got named as a person, so it's treated as a being. And, you know, they tell me they treat the river like it's their grandmother, you know. Uh-huh. And so interesting times ahead where now governments with the indigenous people are going to have to figure out how they listen to the river, you know, how do they represent the interests of the river.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Well, it seems like we are definitely stepping into an evolutionary, another evolutionary platform where the systems of monetary management and exchange are morphing into you know, kind of new reckonings about what's worthwhile, what real values are, and also what role the people will play in determining and valuing those assets.
Fits nicely into the public banking, you know, aspiration. And, you know, for First Nation could easily aspire to have its own public bank with all the things, Ellen, you've written about. I mean, the only issue is when are we going to start one? When are we going to experiment? And,
Well, we're trying.
Yeah. We're trying. We are.
Well, Mark, thanks very much for joining us today on this. And we'll be talking to you again as some of these things start to come to fruition. There's so much more to discuss. Thanks a lot.
Fantastic.
Yeah, great talking to you.
That's Mark Anielski, international economist and author of the book Economics of Happiness and the new book coming out called An Economy of Well-Being, Practical Tools for Building Wealth and Happiness. Well, that's it for this week's edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests and to our sponsor, Payment Management, a merchant payment processing company dedicated to economic fairness and justice. Payment Management invites you to receive a free analysis of your card processing needs and costs. More information is available at paymentmgmt.com. Be sure to stay in touch with the ongoing conversations around what's going on in our world of money by reading Ellen's blog at ellenbrown.com. And to learn more about public banking and how you can participate, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. Thanks for listening. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.